Congressman Bill Floor is joining us this evening. Congressman, thanks for being here tonight.
It's been an honor. I look forward to participating on this town hall.
One of the things I'd like to mention is if folks would like to send us questions, they can do that. Questions at WTAW.com. You can call or text 979-695-1620. And we'll get to the questions from the audience in a little while. First, this is the third one of these that you've done. Let's talk about the first two and what you've heard from your constituents, kind of a short recap.
Sure. We had about 9,000 people participate on the call on Tuesday night, which was into the southern part of the district from Brazos County over to Travis County. And we were able to take about two dozen questions. And by the way, there's kind of a delay.
I'm taking care of that right now.
Okay. And so we took about two dozen questions, and we also did a number of poll questions, and we asked our listeners several things, most important issue facing the country now. We also asked which version of town hall format like they like better, Facebook face-to-face town halls or teletown halls. And we had a majority of each of the nights that preferred the telephone town halls, which, and that kind of surprised me. So given all the interesting rhetoric we've heard lately about the town hall formats.
Well, let's expand on that interesting rhetoric, because there are people saying, you've seen what's happened to other members of Congress. They've been shouted down. You're not facing your constituents.
Well, I think when I take two dozen questions from Facebook Live or from people calling in, that's facing our constituents. In addition to that, I've met with over 100 constituents over the past 2 weeks during this this district work period. And as a matter of fact, every week that I'm back in the district, I meet with constituents, typically on a small group basis. And actually, you have a better conversation when you can meet with folks four or five at a time, because you can drill into the details of a particular subject matter that they're interested in. And so I feel like we've done a pretty good balance this week in terms of our this work period in terms of visiting with our constituents. Also, last night we had about 4,000 participants between the telephone part of the town hall and the Facebook Live part of the town hall.
Splitting it up, are they more interested in hearing you talk about local issues, issues for Texas, or issues nationally and internationally?
Virtually all the issues we talked about were national or international in scope. We had very few folks that talked about local issues, except to the extent that they asked about a local issue as it pertained to federal policy. So, for instance, one of the questions we got last night was about federal support to local governments for some of our local programs that people got a little spooked about when the president had his announced a skinny budget, which had big reductions in domestic spending. So we had to drill into that and also to let everybody know that at the end of the day, Congress controls spending, not the president, and to let everybody know what I thought the likely outcome would be.
Once again, you can call or text 979-695-1620 or email us questions at WTAW.com. Today, Secretary Mnuchin seemed to send a mixed message based on what he had said before. Today he said, we can get tax reform taken care of. It'll be aggressive, but we can do that. And that's really not what he had said even 3 or 4 days before. So we're kind of getting some mixed signals from the White House and their economic people. Where do you see this?
Well, let me say this. We can do tax reform without having done health care reform first. I will tell you this. It becomes much, much more difficult, though, because one of the things that people hated about the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare is that there were almost $1 trillion of taxes over 10 years that were embedded in that bill. And that is a huge load on the economy. So what we did in our repeal replace legislation that we had queued up 3 weeks ago, which we hope to queue up again next week, is to repeal virtually all of those taxes. When you do that, that takes the tax base from where it is with those taxes and reduces it by roughly $1 trillion. And so when you're doing tax reform, you write your revenue projections back to that new lower base. And so you suddenly unleashed $1 trillion to stay back in the economy in people's pockets or in the pockets of businesses to reinvest in people, plant, and equipment, and so forth. And so you can do it, but you can't get the rates as low. You can't be as aggressive in some of the things like instance expensing for businesses when they invest in planting and write off the cost of expenses in the first year. So we can do it. It just becomes a lot tougher. So I'm hopeful that We still do health care reform first, and then we segue over to tax reform.
Now, one of the other situations that we've talked about, you have done it when we have talked on the radio, and I'd like to get more thoughts, especially if you've gotten feedback from some of your constituents when it comes to a high-risk pool.
Right.
Let me quote Jackie's letter from College Station.
Okay.
I listened carefully to your explanation of invisible high-risk pools in the last two town halls, and I've looked at the numbers. A Commonwealth Fund study estimates that it will have cost the federal government $178 billion per year to fund a national high-risk pool in 2014, while the American Enterprise Institute estimated the annual cost at $15 to $20 billion. Obviously, there may be differences based on how the pool is set up, but both of these estimates are huge compared to the $2.5 billion that Senator Ryan has Speaker Ryan has proposed to spend annually on a high-risk pool. Could you please address the discrepancy and what limits or waiting periods might be there?
Sure. First of all, there would be no waiting period. So what we are proposing to do is set up an invisible risk pool like the states of Maine and Idaho used successfully, which resulted in average premium decreases of 30%, not only for non-high-risk patients, but also for high-risk patients. And based on the studies that we've seen, the cost for 2 years of a federal high-risk pool would be about $15 billion. So we set that money aside in the last version of the American Health Care Act that we proposed right before we left for this district work period. In addition to that, we have another $115 billion to provide state support for high-risk pools over the next 8 years. So to answer Jackie's question, we've got the resources there so that we cover those patients, high-utilization patients, which are typically folks that have high-risk pools. We lower premiums for everybody. And then the folks that are in the high-risk pool, they're rated on a community basis, so they get the lower premium. They get the benefit of the lower premiums, and they get coverage. And then the costs are paid for not only with the federal subsidy, but also with there'd be a small fee on every insurance policy written that would go into to fund those high-risk pools.
Question we got from another listener. Can we have a Trump Care plan that will mean lower prices for all citizens, same benefits, and everyone who is now covered can remain covered at the same or lower prices as those benefits?
Well, no, and here's why. First of all, the federal government has set these minimum essential health care benefits, which not everybody wants. And so what we're proposing to do is to allow individuals and insurance companies to match what each wants. The insurance company can decide what they want to sell, and the buyer can decide what they want to buy. And so people may decide, okay, I want to buy a catastrophic plan only, and then I'll set aside money in a health savings account to cover everything else. With the savings I get from the lower premiums, other people, you know, people my age will say, I don't need pregnancy coverage, but people that are younger and childbearing years are going to buy pregnancy coverage. And so we'll have a system where people buy the coverage they want. And so when they do that, typically they're going to pay a lower cost, and everybody, and they'll have more access to care because you typically have lower costs. I mean, if you go back to the promises that were made in Obamacare, remember those? We're going to have improved access. We're going to have lower costs. Oops, those failed. Okay, if you wanted your doctor, you keep it. Oops, that one failed. If you like your health insurance plan, you keep it. Nope, that one didn't work either. You know, so there's a perfect record of failure with Obamacare. I'm finding it kind of interesting now why everybody suddenly always loves it. Well, it's a small group of people that love it. But it's an absolute failure. The cost per capita to the federal government, to the federal taxpayer, has been 50% higher than originally projected.
Go ahead.
And so, to me, what we do will be immensely better than that. So people will be able to buy the coverage they want to, and it'll be a lower cost.
I need to circle back because we didn't cover one part of that question a moment ago, and that was the discrepancy between what the Commonwealth Fund said it would cost and the second group. So what's the reason that the Commonwealth Fund said it was going to be $178 billion, and I think the Enterprise Institute said it was going to be less than that?
Well, I don't know. It's really interesting. I do see you can crank out any kind of a study you want. Look, I can do a spreadsheet to say that high-risk pools are going to cost $5 billion a year. I can do a spreadsheet that says they cost $100 billion a year. It depends on the assumption. What people only read the executive summary. They never dig into the weeds to see what's in there. So I don't know. I can tell you what we know and what we have designed, and it's about $15 billion for 2 years and then $115 billion worth of state support for the next 8 years after that.
Stay with healthcare. This was a question from Theus in Austin. The GOP replacement plan was absurd. Not only did it kick millions of Texas children off Medicaid, changes were being made up until the last minute. So do we not even know what the final bill will look like? However, can we be assured that we will have sufficient time to review, research, and debate this bill before it's put out?
Well, let me say this. The statement that children were going to be kicked off is absolutely false. Off of Medicaid. Look, the SCHIPS program was not touched. And a matter of fact, we anticipate that that will be reauthorized this year without any material change. And so that's where the bulk of children are getting, the Medicaid children are getting their coverage. So that statement we can kick out the door. In terms of the last minute changes, yes, that was not what I'd like to see in terms of regular order. And as a matter of fact, the caucus that was asking for all these changes was one of the, they were the people at the very beginning said, by golly, we got to have regular order. But then, you know, they decided they want to go negotiate their own deal with the White House. Then they kept moving the goalpost around. And so, yeah, I'm frustrated about that, just like our, like Theus is. And yes, we are going to do something that goes back to regular order where we take it back to the committees and everybody will, the committees will have a chance to look at it. The American public will have a chance to look at it. And we in Congress will have a chance to look at it.
It's time to talk about this again. We've talked about it before on our radio show, and it's time to talk about it here. You wanted the House, you got the House. You wanted the Senate, you
Correct.
Got the Senate. You wanted the White House, you got the White House. People are tired, they're angry, they're frustrated, and I guess we don't have a good enough answer yet as to what's the problem.
Well, I'll be quite frank, and I pull no punches on this. We as the Republicans in the House are our own worst enemy right now. They're a group of my fellow colleagues that think it's more fun to tackle their own quarterback than to try to be part of a winning team to advance something across the finish line. And ostensibly they're saying they're doing it on their principles, and their principles being we got to have this perfect solution. Look, we've got 537 people in Washington that are elected policymakers. None of them are perfect, so we're not going to put together a perfect solution. And so I always try to remind my constituents, our constituents, when I pull this voting card out that belongs to them and I drop it in the slot, I've got a yes button and a no button. I don't have perfect. And so I have to look at the options available in front of me and what the outcome is of those. And if I vote no on health care reform, I'm voting to sentence our constituents to what they got now, which is Obamacare. They don't like it. And so if I can get something, if I can get 80% of perfect or 70% of perfect, and it's better than what we got today, I'll vote for that all day long. But we got a group of people in Congress that don't feel that way yet. And I think there's some other things going on. I can't really frame it. I mean, a desire to be on TV and desire to get their name in the press. I'm not sure. But I'm hopeful that if those folks will go back home and say, you know, do you want to keep your Obamacare? They're going to say no. If they'll just think about their vote based on the answer to that one question, they'll come around and start trying to negotiate something. I mean, Ronald Reagan once said, look, I'll take half a loaf. It's better than no loaf.
Sure.
Yeah, we got to quit tackling our quarterback. We got to do what's achievable, the most conservative achievable outcome. Because if we strive for the perfect outcome, we get nothing.
Email questions to us at questions@WTAW.com, or you can call and text 979-695-1620 so you can talk to the congressman directly. This is the kind of question that we get from that one individual out there that's replicated many times in districts throughout the country. Because I have insurance, I am alive today after fighting cancer. When I asked the front desk at the local hospital what happened to people who don't have insurance, I was told they sell everything they own, borrow from people, and then usually die. People being uninsured is not always their fault. So what is your solution for those people?
Well, let me say this. Under the laws that exist in this country, nobody goes without health care. If you show up at the emergency room, you're going to get health care. And if you show up at the emergency room with cancer, the hospital is going to be forced under the law to admit you and to treat you. Today, what's happening is if you've got an insurance card, it's your costs are covered. If you have an Obamacare card and you've got a $14,000 copay, you are going to be out of pocket $14,000. And what we're hearing the hospital say is they're having to absorb that and write it off. If you don't have any insurance, you're still getting treated, but the healthcare provider, and our local providers, are going to get zero. They're going to have to write that off. And that's been hard on us. And that's the reason we want to go back to a system that gives people a chance to buy the health care coverage that they want. And if they want low deductibles, they can have low deductibles. If they want high deductibles, they can buy that. But in terms of people saying that they die because they're uninsured, that is 100% false. That is just a false statement.
JP writes, healthy people will likely pay a lower cost for health care under the plan, but what does this plan do to manage costs for people that have the unfortunate luck of being unhealthy by nature?
Well, that's what we were saying earlier in terms of setting up the latest iteration of the American Health Care Act, set up the invisible risk pools. Let's say I'm a family and I've got a family member that has a pre-existing condition. We would fill out a health questionnaire, but it would still be underwritten as if it were part of a community rating. So I would get the same rates as everybody else that was similarly situated part of the population. Really, the only differentiation is age. And then so I would pay those premiums, and then the insurance company would get that health application, say, oh, this is probably a high utilization patient, and so we're going to ask them to be put into the risk pool. And so they're going to the patient, it's going to look like they got the same coverage as everybody else. It's just that the insurance company slides part of those costs over the risk pool, and those wind up, for lack of a better expression, being socialized costs because they're either partially funded with a fee on every insurance policy or a fee that's subsidized by the federal government or by the state.
Congressman Bill Flores is joining us this evening in the third of his town hall meetings. Questions at WTAW.com, or you can call and text us at 979-695-1620. I don't know if it's because it's 420 day, but we have a question here today. Where do you stand on the legalization of cannabis on a medicinal level, and will it expand into Texas?
Okay. That's the first question we've had on this town hall series.
It's marijuana day. It's 420.
Yeah, I don't want to make a big deal out of this. I'm against the legalization of marijuana. But at the end of the day, I think it's more of a state issue than it is a federal issue. So I'd kick that question to John Rainey and Kyle Cassell and to all of your respective representatives and senators. So,
well, they sent it in.
Call Schwartner and tell him you want your marijuana legalized.
Okay. They sent it in, so I thought we'd do that.
So,
all right, so
I don't feel strongly about it one way or the other, but Personally, I don't think it ought to be legalized.
So here we are. We're wrestling with this repair and replace.
And marijuana. Yeah.
This from Darby. In 2015, every House and Senate Republican approved and voted for H.R. 132, the Obama Repeal Act.
Correct.
Bill was authored by Tom Price, who is now the Health and Human Services Secretary. The bill was vetoed by the president. Would you support passing that original H.R. 132 again?
I'll tell you what. I don't know who's asking that question, but I'm glad they did.
Okay.
So here we win a majority in the House, we win a majority in the Senate, we win the White House, and so we go into office, we're sworn in on January 3rd, and the first thing we want to do is pull that bill up and repeal Obamacare. And so Speaker Ryan gets up and says, this is what we're going to do in the next couple of weeks. And the Freedom Caucus says, no, time out. We need to see what the replacement part looks like. So on January the 10th, they say, we're not going to vote for that repeal bill, essentially the same as H.R. 132, until you show us replacement. So we take a step back and we say, okay, let's do the repeal part, and then we'll build the replacement, put it all together, weld it all together. And then we roll out the American Health Care Act, which starts with the base of this H.R. 132, the 2015 bill, we call it, and with the replacement pieces added on top of that train car. And they said, no, we don't like that either. And so if you're somebody like me that wants to get something done and try to ease the burden on our constituents, that stuff just drives you crazy. And so, I'd be fine either way. If we want to pass the 2015 bill by itself and then do replacement by itself, I'm fine with that. If we want to bolt it together, I'm fine with that too. I just want to give some relief to the American people from Obamacare as quickly as we can. But at the same time, we do have a group of constituents that say, just repeal it and let the free market step in. The challenge with that is there's no individual market anymore. Obamacare destroyed that. And so we have to set the framework. You've got to basically build in a 3-year glide path to phase out of Obamacare and let and create an environment where the free market will be there and ready to absorb these insurance buyers on January 1st of 2020. And so that's what the combination of the 2015 bill would do, plus the replacement provisions we have.
Well, I think the other thing, we have to at least send some signals to the insurance industry.
Correct.
That something is happening here so that they can prepare themselves for the new way this will be handled.
Right, and I'd go back to, I think it was one of the earlier questions, I can't remember if it was Jackie or Theus, but, you know, everybody talks about how great Obamacare is. Look, it's in a death spiral. Premiums are continuing to go up. People are dropping off their coverage. They're not losing their coverage. They're dropping their coverage because they can't afford it. Or they're showing up at the hospital and they're giving their insurance card and they find out they've got a $7,000 copay. And they say, why am I paying all these premiums when I still don't have any insurance, essentially? 70% of the counties in Texas have one provider. And that provider, which is the same company, is probably going to pull out of most of those counties. We're going to be in a world of hurt. So what we're trying to do is build a stable platform for those companies for the rest of 17 and 18 and 19. So we've got a 21st century healthcare system starting January 1st of 2020.
Well, in Texas specifically, with the largest CHIPS program in America, mm-hmm. we have to be concerned about those people who are indigents and what will the
right.
government be able to do to help them as well.
Well, and one of the things we're going to do on CHIPS is because in the American Healthcare Act, because we have an imbalance in some states that expanded and some states like Texas that didn't expand, every state saying, well, we need, you know, we'd want to know what this is going to do for us. And so what we've done for states like Texas that didn't expand is sort of encourage them to be, to find our new program helpful, is we've decided to take away the cuts that were going to be called DISH cuts, disproportionate sharing cuts, and we were also going to beef up CHIPS a little bit to states that didn't expand. For states that did expand, we were going to let them keep their expansion population. If they want to keep them forever, that's fine, but there's a high turnover in expansion population, so as those people roll off, they can go out in the private insurance market. If they decide if they roll off and they come back on, they could come back on as an expansion person, but with a lower federal match. So we've tried to deal with everything, the children population, the elderly population, the able-bodied population as part of the expansion population, the childbearing moms and their children. We dealt with every one of those issues in a pretty responsible way.
So now I want to move on to taxes because
We were just getting started on
healthcare. Yeah, but the thing is, it is so complicated.
It is.
And you came from business. You were in the business world. Can there be a correlation? You're talking about the Freedom Caucus. Okay, that's the name of the group today that's causing a problem. We're just Republicans infighting.
Right.
You sat in the corner office.
Uh-huh.
You've got a team. The team leader comes in and says, you know, I can't bring them together. You're the owner of the business. What do you say? How do you handle that, and can that translate to what goes on in Congress?
Well, I wish it would, but it doesn't, because you've essentially got 537 free agents. You got two, I mean, the president and the vice president. You got 100 in the Senate and 435 downs. Every one of them is a free agent. They're only accountable to their constituents, and some of them, I'm not sure if they're accountable to their constituents. And so if you're the Speaker of the House or the president or the majority or minority leader in the center of the House, you've got a limited ability to influence people. In the old days, before I got into Congress, you could sort of grease the skids by making sure that people that needed to vote to get an earmark, a special earmark to their district, or you could change their committee structure. I mean, you say, if you don't vote for me, I'm going to kick you off the committee. And actually, that happened a couple of times in the last Congress. And all it does is get people inflamed. And so there's really not much of a way to get people to be disciplined to work as a team, except to just to encourage them to say, are you really doing the right thing for your constituents? And I do know that some outside groups have decided to come in on both sides to go into the districts of the Freedom Caucus, for instance, and advertise against them or advertise for them. I'm not sure if that's helpful either. I don't have a good answer about how to get everybody to be a part of a good team. I would say it's reprehensible to be tackling your own quarterback, though.
Well, as I perceive Donald Trump, he'll find out who the troublemakers are and go hold a rally in their hometown.
I hope he will. I mean, the president's got a pretty powerful Twitter following, and I wish he'd use it more for that than some of the other things he's used it for in the past. Or go hold a rally and be sure and tell the folks in whatever district or state that he's going to, if your Republican member votes no on this solution, this new solution, your member, your elected official is sentencing you to be stuck with a failed program called Obamacare. And he's just got to be that clear with it, because nobody wants to have that outcome.
This is from Cherry, and it goes to you and I with our weekly visits. I talked as the ramp was, we were ramping up for the presidential election, and you were not a Trump guy when it started.
Correct.
And you were outside that fold, but you stepped into it. So what do you believe that you can do as one member of Congress to help this agenda go forward that Trump has gotten elected with?
Well, let me say this. One of the things that's been – look, and I agree. I think Donald Trump is probably my 17th choice. But look, he was our nominee. And when he became the nominee, I support him. And probably the thing that made me support him more than anything else is the fact that he picked Mike Pence to be vice president. And I had worked with Mike Pence, and I had the ultimate of trust. I thought, if anybody understands how to pick a good person to be part of a team, you pick Mike Pence. And so that sort of inspired me about Donald Trump. The thing that's so cool about this White House compared to the last White House is they've got an Office of Congressional Liaison. And it's a team of people that folks like me can call up and say, hey, would you tell the president we don't want a wall in Texas? Or would you tell the president, you know, we need to do this, that, or the other differently? Or would you tell the president, please don't roll out a crappy refugee deal like you did the first time? You know, at the same time, it gives them a direct line to us to say, hey, what sort of feedback do you have on the American Health Care Act? How can we help you? What are your objectives in Congress? How can we help you promote those? And I'll have to say, it has been so awesome to be able to either go to the White House or have a contact that I can call and know I've got the president's ear. And, I mean, I've met with – on this health care, our attempts to get health care done, I've met with the vice president at least four times to try to be part of a team of people, sort of a quiet kitchen cabinet to put this thing together. And it's just so cool. I mean, I met my congressional liaison person from the Obama administration twice, and I wasn't the only person complained. The Democrats complained that the Obama administration had no such function like we have today. So that's my answer, is that We have a good, close working relationship. Do we agree on everything? No. Do I agree with the way he wants to cut budgets? No. Do I agree with a wall? No. But I agree with him on about 90% of what he's trying to do.
Bill Flores is with us. We go until 8 o'clock tonight. Questions at WTAW.com. You can call or you can text 979-695-1620. We've got a call. Let's go to Tom from College Station. Tom.
I wanted to make the point that local physicians and caregivers don't have the luxury of writing anything off. They have to actually give as an expense, and getting a benefit on their taxes. They have to give their free and indigent care away for free with no chance for getting any kind of write-off.
So not a question there, but I guess he wants to give some background.
Well, no, he's exactly right, and I appreciate Tom calling in on that. Let me say this. I wasn't saying that it was a good deal to get to write something off. I mean, nobody wants to write anything off, and that's one of the failures, both the health insurance markets the way they were before because we had a high uninsured population, and it's a failure of what we have today with Obamacare, because people go in with their insurance card and they've got, again, a $7,000 out-of-pocket. That's not insurance for a person that's making $24,000 a year. And so, that health care physician, hospital, whatever it is, they're having to eat that, and they don't like it, and I don't like them having to eat it. So I'm glad Tom sort of pointed that out, because we don't want anybody like that to have to eat anything.
Congressman Bill Flores joining us. He'll be here until 8 o'clock tonight. We're going to take a 3-minute break, and then we'll be back. Thank you.